listen to the voices of our world.
They do radio for no pay because they want to reach out to the community.
There is a lot of work that we all have to do to make the show really effective.
Conservative, liberals, people who are just so hard to one side of the argument, they can't listen to opinions they don't agree with.
I want to get people to start thinking. I want people to react.
But I think most people will listen to you and consider what you have to say and think about it for themselves. And that's what free speech is about.
If I don't disturb anybody, I'm not doing anything.
Welcome to Voices of Our World, a presentation of this station and Mary Knoll. I'm Eileen Bott, and you're either listening to me on your computer or on radio, in your car or in your office or at home. Not counting the growing number of low-power FM stations, there are 13,800 radio stations across the U.S. now, and 94% of you, over the age of 12, are weekly listeners. American listeners spend about 20 hours a week tuned into their favorite stations, and if you stay tuned with us now, you'll get to hear one of Air America's morning mavens, co-host of Morning Sedition, Mark Maron. And then three of the voices behind one of the finest examples of non-commercial local broadcasting, Dan Toomey, David Tierney, and John Penny of WUML 91.5 FM, Lowell, Massachusetts.
In the beginning, there was...
In the beginning, you were wandering through the desert of corporate right radio regulars, Rush Limbaugh, Bill O'Reilly, G. Gordon Liddy, Ollie North, Dr. Laura, Tucker Carlson, and on and on and on. So, if you are someone with an occasional progressive notion in your noggin, for your listening pleasure, you had nothing. Nada. Da-doots. Of course you were listening to the sounds of the 80s. But then came April of 2004.
And then there was light.
Yeah, suddenly there was the progressive oasis, Air America. Now you had a choice. Set your radio alarm to same old, and get, okay, wake up now. Or set that alarm to fire off the snap, crackle, pop of Morning Sedition and get, wake up, sheeple. Air America has upset a legion of detractors' hopeful predictions of an early demise, or at least a post-election death. AAR is alive and well on 50 stations across the country, XM 167, Sirius 144, and streaming at www.airamericaradio.com. The talent lineup starts with Morning Sedition, hosted by Mark Riley and Mark Maron. Unfiltered, with Rachel Maddow and Chuck D. The Al Franken Show, with Al and Catherine Lanfer. The Randy Rhodes Show, with the Annie Oakley of radio. The Majority Report, with Janine Garofalo and Sam Sater. And the roster doesn't end there. On the AM Drive Show, Morning Sedition, you get What's Going On and a way to laugh through the resulting pain. If you are driving, there are comedy bits that will make you want to pull over. These include stand-up comic writer and actor Mark Maron's analysis of Caller's Dreams, the imaginings of The Daily Show alum Kent Jones, and then there's Jim Earle, who has several incarnations, most of whom go by some variation on the name of Mort Milfington, brings you The War on Brains. Host Mark Riley, a radio talk veteran, provides the stable platform which co-host Maron turns into a trampoline. Here's Kathy Golden with the author of The Jerusalem Syndrome, My Life as a Reluctant Messiah, Morning Sedition's Mark Maron.
Well, I'm sure you can remember a time, it wasn't all that long ago, when Howard Stern called himself the king of all media. Well...
I know. Is it me? Maybe I'm a prince of media. You know, I've done a lot of things, but relatively under the radar. You know, that's the weird thing about me.
Not anymore.
I guess. I mean, certainly not this one thing. You know, but very few people would know that I wrote a book or that I had, you know, done as much TV as I have.
You've done a lot of TV.
Yes, I've done a lot of things. I am a king of all media in my apartment.
I was talking to you a minute ago about schedule, mm-hmm. because you really are spread all over the place.
Yeah.
And just listening to you guys, any one of the shows during the day, and Rachel after you, and so on and so forth, and Randy, and there is a lot of homework involved, isn't there? There's a lot of prep work.
Yeah, which makes it, you know, our hours even more difficult than most, you know, because we can't come in at 5, you know what I mean, and go on a year at 6. We've had to be there at 4 to get the news and to crunch the news and work as a unit.
Sure.
And it's been really great, because what happens is the little boys' club, me and Brendan, Jonathan, and Mark Riley, and Dan Pashman, son of Lewis and Linda Pashman, and Kalo, the board guy, we end up hanging out. And it's a weird time, 4 in the morning. It's a very sort of like, you're kind of half asleep. There's an intimacy to the whole thing, and we're really sort of working of one mind there. But there is a lot of work that we all have to do to make the show really effective.
The genesis of Air America is interesting in and of itself, but how did all this come about for yourself, for Marc Maron?
What happened with me was I heard about Air America. I heard it was starting. I heard Franken was involved. I heard Janine was involved. Mm-hmm. And I was in L.A. I just finished writing a series of scripts for Fox that were not made into pilots. And I called Janine. You know, I've known Janine for 20 years. Well, maybe not 20, but at least 15. We're not close friends, but we're friends. You know, we're definitely in the same circle of people. Yeah. And I never really call her, but I called her. I said, who's doing this? I want to get involved with this. And she goes, you should. And she put me in touch with Liz Winstead, mm-hmm. who also I've known for 15, 16 years. And I said, I want to do this. I want to do the morning show. Mm-hmm. You know, I wanted to do this crazy hours to have the opportunity to compete in that
Why,
market.
Why, you still up?
No, I wasn't. I just thought, what would be the point? You know, I wanted to have the shot at competing in a real market. Mm-hmm. And I knew Al was going up against Rush, and mm-hmm. I knew that that's what I wanted. And I sent them a CD. I talked to a few of the other executives. I flew out. I auditioned. They auditioned me with people, you know, and after a series of a couple of months, you know, I became the principal that they were trying to cast around. You know, like, they wanted me. They just weren't sure how the rest of the show would come together.
You and Riley, how do you work things out in the morning when you have this meeting at 4 a.m. and nobody's really awake yet? How do you decide?
We're all awake. Well, Jonathan Larson is producer, so we have a bulk of stories that, you know, he has chosen, and we go over which ones he likes, which one Riley likes, which ones resonate with me. We figure out which stories are essential, and then those are the ones we all get up to speed on. Riley crunches the facts. Riley's very good at processing news and putting things into context. I'm very good at reacting to it, though I'm getting a little better at contextualizing. The smaller stories are, you know, if they provoke me into funny, we'll do some of that. So, you know, basically it really becomes about Riley wrapping his brain around the stories that we're going to present while I sort of, you know, blast through and make my little comments, you know, and make my funnies and try to understand. I mean, originally, a lot of what was going on with me and Riley was I would sort of tell Riley to tell me what's going on, make me understand it. I was learning myself, yeah. And you know, the first few months were horrible because I can be a real
tough,
angry prima donna, not prima donna, but I get very frustrated.
But they were tough technical problems too. I mean, you guys were dealing with, this was the birth of a nation in a sense. I mean,
sure.
This was a big deal.
Yeah, it was hard. It's like I have some sort of block as to just how difficult those times were. That's another benefit of operating in the hours I do, is that nothing seems real. You know, this morning seems very far away already because you're operating in this time zone that you really shouldn't be. So part of your brain thinks you're just dreaming. Riley and I, we get along very well. We have a very good working relationship,
good,
and we're very respectful of each other on and off mic. I don't go to dinner at his house or anything, but, you know, we've developed a great vibe together and a great chemistry and groove, and I enjoy him. I learn a lot from him.
He seems to act as your seatbelt.
Yes, that's good. That's exactly what we want.
Which is nice. It's a nice balance.
It gets scary when neither one of us have a seatbelt. That's when I start to wonder, you know, when we're going to hit the wall.
Okay, I'm now reading Jerusalem Syndrome, but I've never seen you perform it.
You know, I've spent the last month or month and a half rememorizing Jerusalem Syndrome, the show. And, you know, honestly, not only was I crazy when I threw out a lot of my life in terms of that show and what it's about, but when I wrote the show, my marriage was coming apart. You know, I was getting sober. You know, my life was hitting a wall, and this show was the only thing really keeping me together, was that, you know, I had to perform this thing off Broadway. And, you know, all that insanity is behind me now. And, you know, going back to the show that was so crazy in its themes and in its content was now, like, I had to act as crazy as I was then. So I had this distance, and I was able to really perform it with a lot more control than I had doing it originally. So it was really a treat for me to do it.
So you originally read it like Mark the Shark.
Well, it was that manic, in a way. Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, I had that intensity. That was my life, and I was really presenting a certain amount of truth. But now that I have some distance and I've grown out of a lot of this thinking that drove this, I was able to sort of become a character of me back then. And it made the comedy more resonant. It made it a funnier show.
How close is the book to what you do on stage?
There's stuff in the book that I do on stage, and you know, me on a good night is close to this. A lot of this is written. A lot of this has never been done on stage. The show itself is in there somewhere, but I added a lot because I was given the opportunity to write it. There's a lot of stuff in here that's not in the show. So it really reads as a book more than it does a show.
I was thinking as I was reading on the train, sometimes I wonder if the acquiescence of this Middle Earth America that seems to have not noticed when the pendulum swung right and they think they're hearing the real news from a Rushley or whatever, I wonder if they're in their own kind of Jerusalem syndrome, an American version of.
I think that everybody, honestly, is in their own Jerusalem syndrome. I think that one of the great liabilities of having a media that's exploded and having so many options and having an internet and everything else, and then having a mainstream media that is horrendously irresponsible and lax, is that there's no longer any barometer for real facts or truth, and that it sort of becomes this vast buffet of how you want to construct your reality. Ultimately, anybody's going to do that, anybody, whether it's a religious belief or whatever your context of reality is, whether you don't read the news or you do, but it's become very shaky. So I think that most people, unfortunately, I was saying this today, most people don't care about politics really, and even fewer, you know, listen to Air America or read news or whatever. And most people, I think, unfortunately, don't look at O'Reilly or Fox News as being biased. They look at that as being the news. And then, you know, have a very concerted effort on behalf of the right to reframe the dialogue of culture and to demonize liberalism and what they call outlets of liberalism as being horrendous misrepresentations of the facts and reality. So you have a lot of people in this country that believe that anything other than Fox is some sort of horrendous plan, a propaganda scheme on behalf of this slippery slope of liberalism that is, you know, designed to do nothing but undermine the country's strengths. And so on that level, I think more people are honestly apathetic, and I think that's good. I think that on some level you're going to have a better shot at moving apathetic people when the crisis comes, as opposed to, you know, hardcore believers who are unmovable.
That's a good point.
I'm not trying to, you know, find a way to bring in moderates or whatever. You know, a lot of the comedy we do is crass. A lot of it, you know, mocks religion. A lot of it mocks the right. And a lot of it mocks progressives, to be honest with you, and the sort of liberal things that people hold dear. So, I mean, that's where we're going with that. It's amazing how sensitive and self-censoring liberals can be, you know, with the sort of concerns like, what are you doing? You're making yourself out to be exactly what they say we are. It's like, you know, at some point, I think comedy is insanely important. And the only thing that's going to bring people in, especially apathetic people, is if you're funny. Because then you're not preaching. You're not condescending. You're not trying to pander to them because you want them to like you, like this myth of the middle. And, you know, if you can just make them laugh, if the comedy is loaded properly, it will get the message across.
You're sticking with Air America for a while. It's been a phenomenal success.
Yeah, it's up to them now. I mean, I've signed on for up to 2 years, and they have the right to get rid of me. I apparently can't leave, but if they want to get rid of me,
that's wonderful.
Yeah.
That's really good news.
Yeah.
So, who are you listening to? Even if it's not usually us, we want to know. Email us. Go to www.maryknoll.org/voices. Just click on Contact Us. Or you can call us at 877-MARY-KNOLL. That's 1-877-MARYKNOLL.
The revolution starts now.